Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking about a wonderful new exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection with Edwin Blair, book collector, and HNOC curator Mark Cave. We'll also hear from Sarah DeBacher of the Greater New Orleans Writing Project and two very promising young writers, Matthew Drotter and Tyler Dispenza of the Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana. There's a marvelous exhibit up at the Historic New Orleans Collection right now. Don't miss it. It's called Alternative Imprints, John Webb, Gypsy Lou, and the hand-sewn world of the Lou John Press. Here with us to talk about that exhibit are Edwin Blair, an early supporter of the press and a longtime collector of the work of the Beats, and Mark Cave, one of the Historic New Orleans Collection curators. Welcome to The Reading Life, Edwin.
Well, it's nice to be here.
You too, Mark.
It's great to be here.
I saw this exhibit last weekend, and it is really thrilling to see all this gathered in one place. There are copies of The Outsider, that important magazine published by the Webbs, the beautiful books they made, as well as the work of artist Noel Rockmore. It's simply gorgeous. Now, Edwin, you knew the Webbs. You knew John and Gypsy Lou in the very early days. You come to New Orleans to work in the oil business, and you were drawn to them.
Well, I was lucky enough to have a friend who was a professor and teacher, and he had talked to me about literature such as The Double Dealer and The Fugitive, and he recommended that I go down and see this couple that were doing this book. It was not something he was going to be interested in, but he thought I might be, and so we wandered down to Royal Street, and there was Gypsy Lou at the corner of St. Louis and Royal and selling her paintings, and she had a bunch of the outsiders there that she was selling, and he told her while we were down there we wanted to see John, and so she scurried over and made a phone call down to the headquarters there on Ursline where John was working and putting out the third outsider. And he was just finishing up on there. They were actually living on Royal Street. And John welcomed us, and we went into this mysterious French Quarter world of, this was an old, at the time, a large, large building, time very dilapidated. Miss Alou was the owner of the building, and we knocked on the door. John came to it, and then we had a boardwalk of bricks and lumber that we had to cross to get to the back part of the building, which I think at one time must have been a stable, and that's where John had his press. They did not live there. Lou, I think, was living at 1109 Royal at that time, but he was still working it back there. And we got back there, and he showed me the Pekowski things, and he told me that they were ready to print, but they didn't have enough money to buy any paper. So he showed me some of the stuff that Pekowski was writing, and I loved the idea that here was this postman from Los Angeles writing what I thought was not only poignant but humorous material. So I told John, I said, I'll try and help you out. We cooked up a deal between the two of us. I bought 100 books from John in advance, and he had the right to buy them back from me. And one of the weird things that happened was that when the book came out and became successful, John bought about 3/4 of the books, but left me with a quarter. And I just put them in my closet. And in the interim, I was lucky enough to sort of enter their world, and it was a different world than the suburban Connecticut life that I had grown up in. And here we were confronted with Miss Alou and this mysterious nurse that she had, who Gypsy Lou was very nervous about and felt was taking advantage of Miss Alou. And there was a bitter sort of witchcraft goings on between the two of them. Gypsy Lou was afraid of Miss Alou because she thought she was a witch. And then, of course, Miss Alou was afraid of Gypsy because she was the famous Gypsy Lou. Anyway, they eventually left there, And sure enough, Miss Alu ended up with her estate in the hands of this witch woman who had apparently made a career of going around the quarter taking care of old ladies and getting them to inherit things from them. And she ended up getting that building. And Gypsy Lou was the type that never gave up. So she came along and she got in there and went into the garbage. And in the garbage, she found out that there was a missing relative that Miss Alu had who was in Belgium. And she contacted the relative and said, listen, this lady has taken over the estate here, but you have an interest in it. You better come in. And Gypsy Lou being Gypsy Lou caused a lot of trouble. Larry Borenstein eventually bought the building. And of course, now it's one of the most beautiful and gorgeous buildings in the French Quarter owned by the Stone Estate.
So what was that book? What was the first book that you underwrote for them?
It's Catches My Heart in Its Hands.
I love that title, don't you? What was it that got to you about that world and about those people? What was it that pulled you in?
Well, you couldn't help but adore the Webbs. Here was a couple that had given up everything to publish these books and magazines. John had completely changed his life. He wanted to be a writer. Of course, he was an ex-con and had learned about printing and publishing from the prison newspaper. And so when he came to New Orleans, he wanted to be the great new Hemingway. It never happened. He had a lot of frustration. He did have one book published, but he kept running into stone walls. In the meantime, Gypsy Lou was out there on the corner selling her paintings and her prints and whatever else she could hawk on Wall Street. And all of a sudden, he just immediately gave up drinking. He got out of the Bourbon House bar life and took this project on in 1960 and dedicated all of his energies and all of his resources to putting these publications out.
And they are really gorgeous. Now, you've kept up with Gypsy Lou all these years. She was born in 1916, but she's still with us. And John died in 1971. And you have this vast collection of beats, of the material of the beats, really beautiful books. And I know I've been lucky enough to see them. And Mark, what do you think this adds to the holdings of the Historic New Orleans Collection? How do these books round out what you've got?
Well, our holdings are constantly developing. I think traditionally when people think of the Historic New Orleans Collection, they think of colonial documents and 19th century portraits of people. But history's always moving, and so we have to continue collect and try to identify those things which we think were particularly influential in creating our culture. And I think what Mr. Blair has donated to us is really important.
And what do you think it adds to our understanding of the French Quarter in the 60s?
Well, that's what we tried to do with the exhibition, is we tried to place the press in the context of the French Quarter world in which it was created. And we did that by using the artwork of Noel Rockmore, who painted this beautiful homage to the French Quarter painting, which is sort of a centerpiece to the show, which has all of the French Quarter characters from that time pictured in it. And we have paintings of Sister Gertrude Morgan, who was around during that time, and then the work of photographer Johnny Donnells, who was a friend of Gypsy Lou and John.
And lived in the skyscraper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It does make you feel as if you're there. It's mm-hmm. really fascinating. Now, one of the things I know about you, Edwin, is that you've collected this stuff. I mean, if anybody knows the value of a closet full of books, you're the one. And after Katrina, you had a very special auction, didn't you, of this material, of a lot of it?
Yes. I'm a Katrina victim, as was Gypsy Lou. I was over in the wonderful Factors Row building, and I had my beat stuff there, and I also had an ambition of opening an art bookstore. But when the storm hit, there was no elevator, no air conditioning, and I was evicted. At the same time, Gypsy Lou, who was living with her sister in Slidell, after the storm, the sister told her that she was going to move in with her son who lived in Mississippi. So Gypsy Lou was then going to get a trailer, and Dennis Fermento, as a Slidell poet, was going to let her, at least temporarily, put the trailer next door to his house, and she was going to live there. Well, that didn't seem like a very good situation, because Gypsy Lou obviously had no income except for a very, very small Social Security check. So then I decided what I'd do was sell the books. And it wasn't just for Gypsy Lou. I was also thinking, well, what am I going to do with these things? I had talked to my alma mater about giving it to them, but this sounded like a better deal. So I put them up for sale at the Pacific Book Auction, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. Of course, I really didn't need to do it because the sister ended up not moving and Gypsy Lou stayed in the house. So we sold the books, and it was fun for me, and I don't regret it. I'd still have the problem of what to do with them. So Lou was, I think, happy that she could stay with her sister, but eventually her sister died, and we ended up a little over a year ago with the same kind of problem, trying to find a place for Gypsy Lou. And she bounced around from time to time, even lived in Bywater for a short period. But then some of these governmental agencies in Slidell came to the rescue, and she's got a very nice situation where she's got a nice home that's supplied for her and a nice apartment. And I'm happy to say she's 97 and doing fairly well for 97.
And we've had this wonderful resurgence of interest in their circle with this new book by Jeff Weddle, the new film, the documentary about the Webbs. It's been a really great time of rediscovery since Katrina. And then you decided to give these items to the Historic New Orleans collection, right?
Right. In a way, I wish they had shown interest earlier because I can't tell you how much material I had. But this was fortunately sort of my duplicates. And I was really happy when I ran into Mark and got to know him, and he expressed an interest in this. And this is what got me interested in giving it to Historic New Orleans.
Well, the Webbs are one of my favorite stories in all of New Orleans literary history. They're such passionate people. They lived life according to their lights, and their story is as remarkable as the books they made, although the books are exquisite. So now, Mark, can scholars go and look at these books after the exhibit? Can, you know, if somebody really wanted to put on white cotton gloves and handle them, could they?
Yeah, we encourage that. And there's a lot that we couldn't exhibit that we have in our collection. And of course, when you're showing a beautifully handcrafted book, you can't show every page. And so we encourage people to come back. Their final book, which is a Henry Miller book, which is this amazing construction. And we were only able to exhibit the front lid of the book. But you pull open the lid, and inside there's all of these prints of drawings, watercolor drawings that Henry Miller did.
And that's Insomnia or The Devil at Large. And some of Henry Miller's watercolors are part of the exhibit, right?
Yes.
And there will be a very special program Saturday, September 7th from 2 to 4, featuring Edwin Blair, art collector and restaurateur Joanne Clevenger, and Charles Bukowski scholar Neely Tchaikovsky. It's free, but reservations are recommended. Check out hnoc.org for information, and the exhibit is on display until November 16th. Now, Edwin, I have this wonderful quote that I read in one of the letters that Bukowski wrote, which was, "Now looking back, it was a good time in New Orleans, but it could have been a good time anywhere with the right people and enough beer. The right people were there, and the beer was there." You think there was enough beer for everybody?
I think there was the beer. I question how sincere he was about what a great time he had here, though.
He was pretty tempestuous, wasn't
well,
he?
Well, it wasn't that. You know, it was the great clash that took place at the Webbs that I happened to be at, where a wonderful scholar from Shreveport, William Corrington, came down to meet him. He and Bukowski had numerous correspondence going back and forth and back and forth. And Corrington also wrote the introduction to It Catches and was a person who was one of the first academics to really take Bukowski seriously, so he really appreciated it. But it was one of those meetings when Bukowski always said that it's better to write than to get too close to people. And when he did meet Corrington, Corrington had just come back from getting a degree in England and also was sort of moving away from the Bukowski poetry that he himself wrote and was talking about writing the great Southern novel, which made Bukowski gag, I guess. And so when they met, things did not go well, which was unfortunate because one of the projects that Webb wanted to eventually do, which he never had the time or the money to do, was to take the Corrington-Bukowski correspondence and make a book out of it. And I still would like somebody to try and do it. A lot of the Bukowski letters have become public and have been printed by Black Sparrow, but I've really never seen any of the Corrington correspondence.
It's really an amazing letter that Bukowski wrote to Corrington in this exhibit. And he says, the years go faster than the days. And that is the curious thing. That really was an amazing literary feud, too. Again, we've been talking with Mark Cave of the Historic New Orleans Collection and Edwin Blair about the new exhibit, Alternative Imprints, John Webb, Gypsy Lou, and the hand-sewn world of the Lou John Press. Thank you both.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
We have a full house of writing talent today at The Reading Life. Sarah DeBacher is a co-director of the Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana, along with Brad Richard, and she's the director of the Greater New Orleans Writing Project. The Scholastic Writing Awards bring great recognition to the next generation of New Orleans writers, and they're about to swing into action this fall with a fundraiser and launch party September 15th here at the UNO Alumni Center. Sarah's brought along some past award winners to talk about the program. Matthew Drotter is a graduate of Lusher Charter High School, and he's entering his freshman year at Loyola University. Tyler Dispenza is a NOCA grad who's a freshman at Xavier this fall. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome to The Reading Life, and y'all really have to read. So, Sarah, when did this program get started here, and what's your involvement with it?
My involvement, the Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana, is a program of the Greater New Orleans Writing Project. I have just started directing the writing project over the past year and have met all of these wonderful writers and writing teachers. And of course, one of them is Brad Richard. And he'd been running this program, I believe, for 3 years and wanted some help. And I said, I'd love to help out, partly because the mission of the writing project is to improve writing and the teaching of writing in New Orleans schools. And I knew from having done some research into the awards that they work, that they really help celebrate the work of creative teens. So I'm now co-directing with him, and I'm very excited about meeting all of these young writers and helping them get the recognition they deserve.
So you're all in.
Oh, I'm all in.
So how many teenage writers does this impact?
The awards themselves nationally, I know it's thousands. Mm-hmm. And over the 90 years that the awards have been around, I mean, they were started in 1923. I'm certain that it's in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands. And of course, you've got the big names of Joyce Carol Oates and Sylvia Plath and Truman Capote, all of whom at one point won Scholastic Writing Awards themselves. In New Orleans, we typically get submissions in the hundreds. I
wow.
think last year we had about 400 submissions from teens in grades 7 through 12 across the New Orleans metro area. So pretty cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So Matthew, let me ask you. You've said that working in this project, writing about New Orleans has changed the way you felt about your city.
Yes, on many different levels. Because when I started writing, I used to hate writing about New Orleans, because I thought there was nothing to write about. And it was just last year when my senior project was focused on the city where I realized that there was so much to draw from. And I've really started to love the city way more. And it's just been all in my writing.
Mm-hmm. But you've drawn from influences outside of New Orleans, certainly. There are many writers who are really important to you, aren't there?
Yeah.
Who are some of those?
I love Virginia Woolf.
I know, I love that too.
Yeah,
that made me very happy to read that.
She's one of my favorites. Flannery O'Connor is one, and recently Truman Capote.
So what are you going to read for us today?
I'm going to read my poem, Apollo, in memory of.
Okay.
Is there truth in the tree? The first time I heard your voice panting, no love now, only loveliness within the laurel. I'd wash my limbs in the rain next to you. Feel your pulse jump in the wood. In my dreams, we caress light and broken in branches. In morning fog, Your spreading shadow assures me I no longer have to chase it. A wind comes. Wind that once brushed your legs, face, uncombed hair. Will the gods help you? Is it a smile engraved in laurel leaves?
Wow. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, Tyler, you're off to Xavier. How has being part of this program given you more confidence in yourself as a writer?
Well, writing for Scholastic has helped me see my work in a different way. When you're putting together a collection, you tend to notice different things about your work. And I realized a lot of my stuff was focused more on sound, which is what I was exploring last year for my, I guess, my senior project as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right. And what are you going to read for us today?
A piece titled Trans-Mississippi, which was sort of a prose slash poetry piece in a way.
Oh, thanks. It's very beautiful.
Thank you. Trans-Mississippi, Part 1. The back door screen has been peeling back. Warbler CCC rises from the sun-bleached water basin. The air today dry and definite. Birdie's presence lectures on how a grown woman shouldn't lie about like this. There are shields against what a grown woman shouldn't do. They are all a cracked pale yellow, the paint on the walls. I'm craving alligator pears. I don't care too much for taste, just for the texture of a thing. All that easy flesh and pit, the seed. Birdie waters azaleas with her back to me, leaning on her crutch. Her skirt airs what was salvaged, yet she feels the rest too. Right down there, in that damp soil, in those cool beginnings in the milkweeds. She wriggles her toes, and damn it if the pain ain't phantom because she feels it. Birdie's thick ankle stiffens as the skin draws tight, stalk-like and plainly beautiful. My breasts are peeking sore beneath my blouse. Come on over here with that shovel scent. The autumn months still laughs into their peculiar cruelty. The abundance of fallen leaves, the soft chill, and our brick house contracting as a termite colony makes mud tubes through the cracks. I sit up. Our wind chimes hardly strain. Birdie must be looking for that copperhead. I loosen the quilts and they fold on the swing. No one's as sorry as they ought to be on God's blessed day. The shovel's neck slides in my palms. I pass it to Birdie, her fingers curling around the handle in a knuckle, the blade skirting the grass. Leaf crushed under my toes, the crutches against my shoulder feel warm as Birdie rests them there. The snake lay coiled in the earth, inert except for the darting of its tongue, our thirst for piety exposed and vague where it hovered in poppy's scent. She jabs quick at the head with the blade, sunlight frays beside corn marigolds, the sun yet just hours before its plunge. They shall look the dust like a serpent, like the crawling things of the earth. They shall come trembling out of their strongholds. They shall turn in dread to the Lord our God, and they shall be in fear of you.
Wow. If it wouldn't dent everybody's ears, there would be loud applause right now for both of you. What amazing work, both of you. Thank you so much. Now, Sarah, how can people get involved in this project?
They can visit gnope.org, our website, where we'll be sharing information not just about the launch of the submission season, which begins September 16th, so the day after our launch and gala, and we'll have an announcement there as well of a series of workshops that will be held here at UNO, where really talented writers help teens who are interested in submitting work throughout the creative process, because of course, you know, there's a lot that goes into creating these pieces. So yeah, visit the gnope.org, that's gnowp.org, to find out more about the submission season and about submission requirements. Our submission deadline this year is December 15th, so there's lots of time to work with teachers, to get feedback, and to get help from some of the writers who will be working with the Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana here at the workshops.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you all so much for coming in. We've been talking with Sarah DeBacher, co-director of the Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana, along with writers Tyler Dispenza and Matthew Drotter. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Writing Institute at the Arts Council of New Orleans will offer a 12-week workshop in fiction and creative nonfiction taught by writer James Nolan. That runs Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 9, from September 25th to December 11th. Registration starts September 3rd. For more information, visit artscouncilofneworleans.org or email jnolan77@bellsouth.net. Margaret Haddox Peterson signs Wrist and Lisa McMahon signs Island of Fire, two new books for young adults, Tuesday, September 3rd at 4 at Octavia Books. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson, Tuesday, September 3rd at 5:30 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Rebecca Morgan Frank, author of Little Murders Everywhere, is the first featured reader in the 1718 reading series, the student-run literary group, Tuesday, September 3rd at 7 at the Columns Hotel. James Cobb discusses Flood of Lies, the St. Rita's Nursing Home tragedy, Tuesday, September 3rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Al Scramuzza, the former owner and proprietor of Seafood City, discusses his role in shaping local culinary history with Liz Williams, founder and president of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, Wednesday, September 4th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The New Orleans Literary and Performance Series will host a reading by Bukowski scholar Neely Tchaikovsky and former poet laureate Julie Kane, along with other jazz poetry and music, Thursday, September 5th at 7. Check out the New Orleans and Literary Performance Series Facebook page to find out the venue and to RSVP. Saturday, September 7th, will be a busy day at Octavia Books. Brian Floca signs his picture book, Locomotive, at 10:30 a.m. The Newbery medalist, Susan Cooper, signs her new book, Ghost Hawk, at 1:30. And Michaela Haas signs Dakini Power, 12 Extraordinary Women Shaping the Transmission of Tibetan Buddhism in the West, at 6:30 p.m. That's all Saturday, September 7th. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents a program celebrating the new exhibit, Alternative Imprints, John Webb, Gypsy Lou, and the Hand-Sewn World of the Lou John Press. That's Saturday, September 7th from 2 to 4 at the Williams Research Center at 401 Charters. Panel participants are today's guest, Edwin Blair, who donated many of the materials in the exhibit to the Historic New Orleans Collection, Joanne Clevenger, owner of the Upper Line Restaurant and avid art collector, and Neely Tchaikovsky, a poet and Charles Bukowski scholar. Admission is free, but reservations are encouraged. Check out hnoc.org for more information. Poet Mark Statman reads from his new book, A Map of the Winds, followed by an open mic Sunday, September 8th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Monday, September 9th at 6 to talk about fall books and upcoming events. Check their Facebook page, Women's National Book Association of New Orleans, for more information. Pat Coco signs her book, Priory, Louisiana, Tuesday, September 10th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. And get out those dictionaries. The Jefferson Parish Library will hold its first adult spelling bee, Wednesday, September 11th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.